brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Take it away, Dennis. You're ready for this. You're ready for
you
this.
You think so?
I think so. Yeah.
All right. Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target.
No, that's NPR voice.
Oh, okay. You tell me what kind of voice you want, and I'll
I don't know. You need to be like assert yourself, you know? You need to get your man voice on a little
okay.
bit.
Okay. See, I don't want to do... Ian was just naturally... like, he just had it. So I wanted to try and do something different, but...
Confident.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. Welcome, everybody.
That was pretty good.
Okay.
That was pretty good.
Do we need to do a third take?
No. I think that was good.
Okay.
I think that's good.
They're going to be interested when this is how it begins.
Yeah.
Welcome to episode 462. My third or fourth, I think. Third solo.
Dennis, do you drink?
I'm not going to say heavily, but yes.
On the upper end of social.
Sure. Yes. Okay. Okay. Very fair.
Because when we hit like episode 400, I wanted to just like do the drunk episode, and Ian doesn't drink.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, we're coming up on 500 before too long.
Now, I'm sure you have some connections within the military. What kind of party would you like? I don't want to call it a party, but a celebration. It for sure is a celebration. How would you like to commemorate episode 500? Because half a thousand, that's a big milestone.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not in the military anymore, so I'm not going to celebrate quite like that. We're not going to drink Miller High Life.
And the champagne of beers.
The champagna of beers. Yeah, we're not going to drink Southern Comfort. We will evolve a little bit.
For sure not.
That was like the first thing, as we will get in with Ben Blum today about Ranger Battalion culture. Like the first day I showed up and they got me drunk off my ass.
Your first day.
On Southern Comfort, yeah. And I ended up in the shower at like 2 a.m. puking all over myself. It was
at least you were in the shower.
Yeah, well, you got to think about these things ahead of time, you know.
Oh, did you think about that? Because, after that much Southern Comfort, which is, oof, God bless you.
It is one of those things that, like, if I smell it, yep. I will.
That's Jaeger for me.
Yeah. Jaeger, I ended up quitting Jaeger later on down the line.
Not for me.
Yeah.
One bad experience. Slept on a toilet. Literally just out.
You're a better man than me. I probably had a dozen bad experiences before I finally called it quits.
Outside of Jaeger, I don't know if there's another one that I don't enjoy Southern. But it's like you said, you know, you're young, you're trying everything, and then you evolve. Like, so what is your liquor of choice now?
I think like a good scotch. Like
okay, I'm with you.
Macallan, even Johnny Walker.
Okay. My ex-girlfriend, her father was a big scotch guy, and I started dating her in my early 20s. So I didn't have the refined palate I do now, which is a joke, guys. Calm down. So he would buy me scotch books, and he was big, like Oban, Macallan, Glenlivet, Glenfiddich, mm-hmm. like the whole nine. So I've learned to appreciate the culture, and scotch is one of the classier things you can drink. So for episode 500, I think scotch is in order.
That sounds like a plan.
Okay.
That sounds like a plan to me. Great.
And now do we have a scotch guy?
Man, I mean, I don't know that we have a guy. Maybe do I need to locate a guy?
No, not necessarily, but I feel like you know, you get the one bottle of something you enjoy, but then you almost kind of want like a what's the bottle back here?
Tabiki, I think.
Like, I almost want to try something different in the scotch realm where that, you know, you get one that you know for sure is good.
Yeah.
And then you get one that's like, all right, let's try something different.
Yeah.
I feel like you're way more cultured than I am. So you definitely have.
That's debatable. But, Lafroy is another one.
Oh, Lafroy. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
We can put some feelers out there, get some recommendations.
I'm all ear. I think Dave Richardson would have plenty.
That's a good call.
He was a good.
I got a nice note from him in the mail the other day. He read my book and enjoyed it.
He was very charismatic, and that's what you want in an interview.
Yeah. No, he sent me a very nice letter, and I need to hit him up and say thank you for reading. Otherwise, what do we got going on? We have the interview today. We have Ben Blum coming on, the author of Ranger Games. He is the cousin of Alex Blum, who is one of the 2nd Ranger Battalion Rangers who robbed a bank in Tacoma back in the day. And Ben's book, I mean, we'll talk all about it with him, but it's almost a family history. It describes the bank robbery itself, but most of the book is about the why. Why did they do this? Why did it happen? So we'll get into all of that with him.
Which, I mean, I was telling you before we started recording, I've enjoyed every interview we've done in the 2 weeks before Ian departed and in the three episodes that I've been here. I've enjoyed, everyone brings something different to the table, with the overall theme being either you're in the military or you have some kind of military connection. And it's interesting because it's a melting pot, but the overall theme is, hey, like, we're all under this umbrella together. This one really caught my eye because you talk about it often, how, you know, you get people that just support the troops and blindly wave the flag and all this, but then you see something like this, robbing a bank like if this was in the 50s, John Wayne would make a movie about this, and you know, you'd get like, well, hello, pretty lady, and he's sitting there like with his gun on his hip, like, what are you doing? And then you get like an army, like I told you last week, if this doesn't get turned into a movie at some point, I would be shocked. Like, this has everything Hollywood is looking for in a film, in my eyes. And I cannot wait for Ben to come on. I am excited to hear not just the story, but like you said, the why.
Yeah, yeah. And my problem I have with the way the military is presented in all of our media, across all of our media, podcasts included oftentimes, is that it's like this black or white thing. We're like, yeah, the flag waving, or it's like this pinko liberal commie,
right.
You know, damn imperialistic America. And I was afraid that this book, Ranger Games, would kind of fall into that category, that it would be like just sort of like a bland anti-war statement. But really, it's a lot more than that. And Ben will tell us all about it. But it does go into some of the negative aspects of our culture in Ranger Battalion, and maybe some things we can do a little bit better on. And I think there's a valid critique within the book. And I'd encourage people to read it. But we'll talk about that in depth pretty soon here.
I don't know. Did anything major happen over the weekend news-wise? I'm not.
I don't think anything major.
I wasn't in tune. I had some personal things I was dealing with. This isn't really newsworthy, but I always check your Twitter just to see, because you're retweeting articles, you're pumping your own articles, like the Call of Duty one you just had out.
Yes.
One of the things that jumped out, and this is, I don't know, this isn't like newsworthy or anything like that, but you were going back and forth with somebody on Twitter, and it just, your response had me dying, and it's nothing like significant or anything. This one, after Trump, what was Trump's original tweet? Hearing word that Russia, Syria, and to a lesser extent Iran are bombing the hell out of Idlib provinces in Syria and indiscriminately killing many innocent civilians, the world is watching this butchery. What is the purpose? What will you? What will it get you? Stop.
And then
you quote tweet it, talking about Trump, and then, you know, obviously you get the hardcore Trumpers against you. And this one guy, his lingo, your answer was so perfect for his lingo. I don't understand military veteran types who, quote, don't understand Trump supporters, quote, when the POTUS clearly has an edge among vets, even millennial vets. Count me in as part of the Trump crowd any old day. WTF were we to support sport Hillary? And your answer had me dying. I was kind of partial to Herman Cain, old chap. Which is straight out of F. Scott Fitzgerald. That is a Gatsby line through and through. That back and forth was perfect.
Dennis, I'm so glad you picked up on that. Like, somebody actually realized there was a joke in there.
I looked at, because I saw old Chap, and I'm like, all right, in the short weeks that I've known you, I wouldn't think you're just going to throw out an old Chap for just old English, say. Like, there's probably a reason why. So I did, I looked up, and sure as shit, he called you, what was the first one? Was it just sport? No, there was another one. I'm reading it. No, it was, yeah. What were we to support sport? Like,
well, I mean, yeah. How could you possibly, misunderstand Donald Trump or his supporters, even though the guy contradicts himself all the time? Like, no wonder why anyone would be confused. It's just odd to me. I mean, Donald Trump made these very bold statements about killing people in the Middle East, and we need to kill these people and that people and blah, 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 all throughout. You know, that's his very common rhetoric that we've all heard. So for him to, like, take to Twitter to condemn the Assad regime in Russia, bombarding Idlib is kind of weird, just kind of surreal. And that's why I commented. I was like, isn't this what the MAGA crowd always wanted, is to just turn the Middle East into a glass parking lot?
Get the dogs off the leash.
Yeah, take our boys off their chains. You know, like, I thought that was what you wanted. You can consider me amongst the confused. I don't Fair. Always understand what the narrative is that I'm supposed to believe. Like, it's not that I don't believe the narrative. It's that I don't even know what the narrative is anymore.
I don't even know if Trump does.
No, I don't think so either. There isn't one. It's just whatever I say when I wake up in the morning, you're supposed to obey God Emperor King Trump and just go along with it and throw your MAGA hat on.
Like, he throws on Fox News, he sees what's going on, and he just says the opposite. You know, they're bombing the Middle East. Why are we doing that? And it was like, well, 2 months ago, like you said, X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, why are they bombing Idlib where all these terrorists are? While we're bombing the shit out of, we bombed the shit out of Mosul, we bombed the shit out of places in Afghanistan, we drone strike the shit out of families in Pakistan, like, where our bombs are waylaying Yemen. I mean, like,
he'll forget that part.
Yeah. So, yes, I am confused. I'm a little confused about.
Now, this gets me to thinking, obviously, Trump is huge on Twitter. As you were talking, I literally thought in my head, if there was one other person, political leader, that you would, for entertainment purpose, for whatever reason, that you would want to see tweet like Trump does, my first instinct was Kim Jong-un. Like, I would love to see what he comes up with on Twitter.
There is one. It's called DPRK, DPRK News, and it's a parody account for the North Korean government.
Yeah.
And it is fucking hilarious. I actually haven't been on it in a long time, but it's go ahead and take a look at that. DPRK News Service.
Yeah, but I mean, you look at Trump and it's embarrassing that Trump is almost like, for the first thing that comes to your mind is a parody account when I asked you who would you like to see tweet like Trump does. And
well, real life is more like parody every day.
Yeah.
I was watching, I saw this headline that a couple of veterans had walked out on Ocasio-Cortez during a meeting.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, okay, maybe that's something I should write about, for our website. So I went and watched the news clip on Fox News.
And you tweeted.
I was like, dude, this is like an SNL skit. Like, is this real? And it has this little news segment with these two older veterans has like everything in it. It's like these two boomers complaining that Ocasio-Cortez said something about how we're dropping bombs on Yemen or our bombs are falling on Yemen, as I described a minute ago. And they like walked out because they were like, oh, she's anti-American. And they were like just kind of whining. And the Fox News hosts are, you served our country. Why were you just, you were so disgusted with her that you had to turn your back and walk out? And, it's just everything inside this one news segment. It's like, this is literally a Saturday Night Live skit. Like, you couldn't make this up.
It was right-wing bingo.
Like, yeah,
it,
yeah.
Yeah. You're just sitting there with your stamp and grandma next to you.
Thank you for your service right there in the center block. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the free space. Make sure you mark the middle. Space.
Yeah. So it's just surreal. But I wrote that. I did write that that op-ed about Call of Duty, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it. You can go read it if you want. But the Call of Duty games just have this particular brand of nihilism to them that, you know, we're just like a bunch of thugs deployed on the global war and terror, and no one really knows or cares what we're fighting for. And it's this very romanticized but also nihilistic vision of what we're doing around the world. And I wrote about that, and it was funny. Some of the feedback you get is, it's just a video game, who cares? Well, if you read this book here, Ranger Games, all this thing talks about, well, it's not all it talks about, but video games are prominent throughout this book.
Okay.
And all these young guys playing video games and their favorite movies, war movies. And so I'm not saying that video games make people rob banks or anything like that. What I'm saying is that video games and movies have a influence on our culture.
They contribute.
Right.
It's not the driving factor, but sure, if you're playing Call of Duty or any other, you know, warfare game like that, and you're just playing and, you know, you get this almost desensitized, like, just, you know, you mowing people down, who cares?
When the video game is saying you are the special operator, you go and you shoot civilians, like that's what you do. What you have to do. Like, one of the games is actually like it encourages you to murder civilians. You're like undercover with the terrorists. And yeah. And I'm not before anyone starts going apeshit on me, I'm not calling for censorship. I'm not saying these games should be illegal. I'm just telling you that for me, I look at it and I say, I don't really want to participate in this, and I think it's kind of gross.
Yeah, I mean, with the Call of Duty, I think it's Call of Duty that does the they had the Nazi zombie segment of the game, and that you can get behind because it's like zombies, and I have no problem killing zombies. They're not real. Well, I mean, in the video game, they're certainly not real. I don't know how you feel about them in real life, but when you start. When the mission tells you to mow down innocent civilians,
yeah,
that's getting a little dicey.
I, my favorite games, or one of my favorite games, are the Deus Ex series.
Okay,
and I really like it because it puts you are playing in the first person as the protagonist, and it puts you in these very ambiguous, morally gray areas. And then it presents you with a series of decisions. There's multiple pathways to take in the game.
So, okay, that's nice.
So you have to decide which path you're going to take. And none of them are clearly good or bad.
Yeah, the whole thing's gray.
It's very gray, yeah. I mean, there are some things you could do that are clearly like psychopathic, I guess, if you wanted to play a more evil type of character. Or if you wanted to play like the morally virtuous...
like the White Knight.
Sci-fi paladin, yeah. but most of it in the game is very gray. And you really have to balance... or try to figure out, you know, where would I stand on this? Like, what would I do? And I think those kind of games are cool because they make you think about it. You know, they make you contemplate.
Right. Like, it's not black and white. Like, you know, if I do this, this is what's going to happen. And if I go this way, then, like you said, you're thinking more about it. And you said in the Call of Duty piece that when you first played it, the Call of Duty one, that is, you just started shooting the terrorists. And then they just prompted, like, they just... There was an automatic, like, look, we're killing you. Like, this isn't what you're supposed to follow. Like,
that was in Call of Duty, too. So, yeah, the game is telling you what you're supposed to do. Yeah. Like, hey, look.
And it's like, well, now I don't want to... That's not as fun. Yeah. I like the games where it almost choose your own adventure. Those of you who remember those books.
And I do... I mean, I don't play that many video games. I just don't have the time. I just don't have the inclination. I play a couple, maybe one or two a year. But, I mean, I like video games. I even like shooters, you know?
Yeah. Not a military man, but it's interesting because I would like to get, yeah, I mean, like you said, you play shooters, and I have one friend that's a huge gamer, and one of his close friends was in the army, and he doesn't mind playing it either, but I'd like to get a perspective that, like, you know, you lived it. So when you play a video game, is it kind of just like... this, like, do you nitpick it? Like, is this realistic? Like,
yeah, no, I don't really feel the need to nitpick it. I just think that you know, that Call of Duty game, I'm looking at this trailer and it shows these characters, they're doing halo jumps, they're inserting on little birds and things, and it's like stuff I actually did in my military career. It was kind of, okay, that's kind of cool, but then the way it gets kind of contextualized, you know, it's just something that I feel kind of uncomfortable with, I guess.
Fair enough. Before we bring on Ben, do you want to discuss anything further? Any other articles?
There's another article I wrote that'll be coming out today, so it'll certainly be out by the time people listen to this. Is about the United States trying to repair our relationship with the Indonesian Special Forces, who have a bunch of human rights accusations against them over the years. So it looks like we're trying to repair that relationship, which I'm sure plays into China asserting itself in the South China Sea. We need some allies out there in the Pacific. And then I wrote another article, still touching it up. I'm not going to get into the subject matter yet, but it should be out by the time people hear this, I think.
Let's hope so, because you told me the topic, and just from the topic alone, it'll be another quality piece.
Well,
I can tell.
It's gonna be one of those pieces where I get death threats. I know. I mean,
that makes it a good piece, though.
No, it is. I'm gonna get it all over again. That's just part and parcel of the job, though. But yeah, I don't want to say what it's about just in case it doesn't go out tomorrow. But pretty controversial subject matter that will come out hopefully tomorrow.
That's a tease in the biz. That's what they call that.
Yeah,
that was well done.
Yeah. So we'll see. It should be out by the time people hear this.
All right. And then up next, we have Ben Blum, author. He wrote Ranger Games, a story of soldiers, families, and an inexplicable crime. But before we get to Ben, this show is brought to you by Crate Club, a club for men by men of gear handpicked by Special Operations military veterans. Visit crateclub.us for an exclusive promotion for our listeners of 20% off your subscription. This is the biggest discount we've ever made available, and we're not entirely sure how long it's going to last, so you might want to get on it now. Go to crateclub.us, use the coupon code SOFREP, and get 20% off any subscription. That's crateclub.us, coupon code SOFREP, S-O-F-R-E-P, for 20% off. Sign up now. And here's Ben Blum. With us now, we have Ben Blum, author of Ranger Games, a story of soldiers, family, and an inexplicable crime. Ben, you got your master's in fine arts from NYU, your PhD in computer science from the University of California, Berkeley. And then when you found out your cousin committed this crime in 2006, you left your job and you just began the research on, like, what? Take us through that process. Like, you just decided, all right, this is an interesting story. We're going to get right into, like, I want to write the best book possible. So in order to do that, I'm going to have to leave my job.
Interesting kind of doesn't begin to cover it. It was a giant family catastrophe when my cousin was arrested. He'd been the kind of goody two shoes, patriotic, all American, kid of the family. And it shocked us all when he was arrested for bank robbery. I mean, it was just so completely out of the blue. So I was working at the time at a biochemistry lab doing my PhD research, and about 10 months into Alex's imprisonment, he wrote an account of his training, both basic training and then the Ranger indoctrination program. And I read that and was kind of blown away. I started to just get more personally invested in the story and trying to understand how this kid that I knew growing up had come to the point of robbing a bank. So he and I started communicating. I wrote him a couple letters while he was in prison. He wrote back. Friendship developed, and over time that grew into a joint plan to write a book together about his story.
It's pretty incredible because the book, Ranger Games, it's a book about really a lot of things. I mean, it's a family history. It's about the process of you writing this book with Alex. And then it's also the main point of it. I think the main thrust of it really is the why. Why did this happen? But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you the what, because I think there are some people who are coming to this fresh and have probably no idea what we're talking about. If you could describe to us the bank robbery itself and how that went down before we move forward.
Sure. So Alex was a 19-year-old private at the time in the 2nd Ranger Battalion at Fort Lewis. Now it's Joint Base Lewis-McChord. The robbery was organized by his former team leader, Specialist Luke Elliott Summer, There were five guys involved in the robbery, three Rangers and two Canadian associates of Summers. And Summer, when he first started concocting this plan, pitched it to those around him in battalion as a kind of a thought experiment. Like, let's think how we do a real bank robbery using our skills.
Which is very common, I might add, to spitball about that kind of thing.
So I hear. I mean, as I understand, I'm not, of course, a Ranger myself. I have no military experience whatsoever. Everything I know about this, I know at second hand through having talked to a number of soldiers in the course of the research for the book. But I've heard that from many sources, that that's a common way to kind of blow off steam and also to exercise your growing tactical skills. You run these thought experiments anytime you're out seeing a movie, you know, getting a drink at the bar, getting a sandwich at Quiznos, and just shoot the breeze with fellow soldiers about it. So that's what Summer was doing for a long time. And Alex started to get involved on that basis. And at a certain point, it just started to get a little bit uncomfortably real. And so at a certain point, you know, it tipped over into full-on reality, and they really robbed this Bank of America branch in Tacoma. Five guys went in, take over robbery. They had AK-47s and pistols. They were inside for about 2 minutes, a very fast-moving, well-executed robbery from a tactical perspective, although from a criminal perspective, totally boneheaded, because they didn't so much as cover up the license plates on the getaway car. And then they got out of there with about $50,000, and Alex was arrested 3 days later in Denver after they tracked the plates.
And as I recall, I pulled the book off my shelf yesterday to kind of refresh my memory. This happened just as 2nd Ranger Battalion was put on leave. So these guys had a little bit of spare time. They went and executed this bank robbery, and then they went, Alex went on leave back home to Colorado, and Elliot Somer went to Canada.
That's right. Yeah, he grew up in British Columbia. He had dual citizenship. His father was an American. So his family still lived up there. He went back to his mother's house and then ended up mounting a year-long extradition battle out there, claiming to have staged the bank robbery to gain a platform to protest war crimes that he'd witnessed in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, that's a whole crazy other story. Yeah. You can get into if you want to.
And the feds caught up on, you know, caught them very quickly. I mean, they pieced it together pretty quickly.
Yeah. The FBI agent in charge of the investigation took one look at the security camera videos and was like, these guys are soldiers. You know, it was pretty apparent that the level of athleticism and just kind of tactical acuity on display in the robbery was way above and beyond anything that he'd seen in his hundreds of past bank robbery cases. In the beginning of the robbery, Specialist Summer just sprints in and vaults clear over this 8 or 9 foot high bandit barrier, the plexiglass barrier separating the tellers from the rest of the bank. It's just a athletically pretty impressive move. So he immediately suspected that they were military. And as I mentioned, a witness to the crime got the plates. He called Fort Lewis and had them check against their records. And Alex was the first one that they arrested, since it was his car.
As I was reading the book, I was going back through last night, I realized that all of the parts I bookmarked in the book, they're not so much about Ranger Battalion, and they're not so much about the bank robbery itself. They're the parts about being a psychopath, and specifically in regards to Somers and some of your conversations with him. And that was some of the stuff that really jumped right out at me. And I felt that it's so telling because of the hierarchy you have in the military and who's in charge of you, whether you have a good experience in the Army or a bad experience depends so much on the personalities and who you wind up with. I mean, is your team leader a good guy or a bad guy? And in this case, Alex ended up with a team leader who is a psychopath. And so I was wondering if you could kind of take it from there about as far as like the why did this crime happen? Why did Alex get involved in it? Why did all of this go down the way it did?
I think that if there's any one deciding factor in Alex getting involved, that is it. Elliot Sommer is a truly unusual guy. And, I ended up coming to the conclusion that that was the best one word summary of what's going on with his brain. And I, you know, certainly that's an opinion that I heard from a variety of sources. He experienced some ugly stuff, I think, on his first two deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq. He became a little disillusioned about the military. There was a political element of that, but also he confessed to me openly that morality had always been kind of a mystery to him. Like, other people did moral things out of what seemed to be an innate drive inside them. But for him, it was like, I guess I could do moral stuff because that seems to be what makes people most comfortable. But I don't really see any reason other than that. So he would kind of imitate moral behavior based on models around him. And then that just meant that there were very few internal checks on him going kind of batshit crazy with this bank robbery scheme.
What do you think it says about Ranger Battalion that a guy like Somers gets in, that he goes through this, the entire selection process that we're told, that we're told is so comprehensive and time tested that we get these elite soldiers, people who are our best and brightest, but you end up with a guy who's a psychopath and he breezed right through whatever psychological evaluations they gave him?
Yeah. Well, I mean, according to him and his family, he wasn't given psychological screening. I don't know how standard that is now. And he did have some difficulty at Battalion for the couple of years that he was there before Alex met him. His platoon sergeant recognized that he was emotionally immature, and Summer's family, when they tried to convey their concerns about his mental health to the platoon, they were kind of rebuffed. But looking at it now, I think there was an emerging picture that Sommer might have some issues. But it jumped out at me finally after all the research I did. I am an outsider at all this, and I have to tell you, it's always a big honor for me to be able to speak to folks like you who have real experience in this world. And I apologize in advance for anything that I get wrong. There's a whole language to this world that I learned as I researched the book, but it's just impossible to be truly deeply familiar with it unless you experience it. The impression that I got is that it's really quite unusual in militaries around the world for an elite special operations force to be formed from raw recruits. Guys will serve a little time in the regular army. The really truly experienced ones then go through the more rigorous training to enter special operations units. And the Rangers, it's just such a fast track to doing really highly sensitive, self-directed missions. You can work hard to weed out the really crazy guys, the guys who are not mature enough to handle this kind of responsibility, to some extent. But to some extent, that's the kind of thing that only shows up over time through experience on deployment, through the different relationships that a soldier forms with different kinds of superiors and teammates and even subordinates if they're given a little bit of leadership responsibility, as Sommer was. It seems that Sommer was given responsibility a little bit too quickly, in my view.
It's interesting that they say that he wasn't given psychological screening. And obviously, I didn't go through the Ranger indoctrination program with him. But, I mean, I went through in 2003, and we had it wasn't comprehensive. But we did have a questionnaire we had to fill out and then a short interview with a psychologist. So it's interesting if they did away with that, what it would have been, you know, not long after I went through that he did, I would suppose.
Oh, that is interesting. Although, you know, psychopaths are kind of famously hard to diagnose because they're brilliant at creating a persona, a seamless, trustworthy persona.
And you did, you went and like talked to his mother and stuff like that and turned up all of these like wild stories of how, you know, a very grandiose personality. And I think you even say at one point that people like him, that people who have psychopathy issues, they think they're much more competent than they actually are, which I think is a common running theme, including the bank robbery itself.
I ended up forming a surprisingly close relationship with his mother, who had this kind of unique combination of clear-eyed view of Elliot and his character, and also that kind of unbreakable mother's love. Like, she wanted the best for him no matter what. Mm-hmm. She told me that all through his childhood he just had gigantic schemes. He was like calling people at NASA to talk about his ideas for space travel. He was like calling Bill Gates to try to get funding for his video game company at age 13. He was always a big dreamer, and it was never clear that he recognized the boundary between dream and reality. He kind of actually thought that he was living out these fantasy versions of himself, these grandiose fantasy versions of himself that would then be very persuasive to friends and other people around him.
I would be remiss too if I didn't ask you about your cousin Alex and a little bit more about his upbringing, which was, you know, in personality, which was very different than Somers, and what their relationship was like in Ranger Battalion.
Sure. Alex had a pretty sheltered upbringing. He grew up in Greenwood Village, Colorado. It's a little suburban enclave. His dad was a pretty successful real estate developer. He had a lot of drive to become a soldier. Our grandfather served in World War II. We grew up with stories of his great military exploits, but I don't think he had much of a sense of the reality of military life. Mm-hmm. Our great uncle told him a little bit about his service back in the 50s, but Alex was the only one in our family who aspired to go military and who knew anything about it. So he had kind of a storybook idea, I think, of what it meant to be a soldier. And, you know, he, like all kids his age who love Army stuff, he just drank up every movie, Black Hawk Down, Saving Private Ryan. He was obsessed. He played all the video games, like endless hours on Call of Duty. And he was very idealistic about it all. He really wanted to go, you know, defend freedom and save America. So then he met Summer, and they connected over hockey originally. Alex was kind of a high school hockey star, and Summer, as it turned out, wasn't, but kind of pretended he was to connect with Alex. He'd played enough to be able to speak convincingly about it, but it turned out he had not actually been on the team that he claimed to have been on, which Alex had once traveled up to Canada to compete against. And they just formed one of those kind of tight, jokey, fast friendships that people form under immense stress. Alex just felt very honored that a tab was interested in him. You know, as I understand it, there's a real social divide between privates and tabs at Battalion. And Summer was one of the few to cross that boundary. He took a special interest in certain privates and would bring them out around Tacoma for extra, you know, quote unquote tactical exercises when they'd visit places and someone would ask them how they'd rob the place. And Alex just felt very honored to be given that attention.
But I mean, there's also a dark side to that relationship too, wasn't there? I mean, there he was having him do things like the suicide check and stuff like that.
It started to get a little culty. So the suicide check was Summer would throw a pistol to one of the guys that he hung out with, one of these privates and his crew, and call suicide check. And then the guy would have to hold it to his head and pull the trigger, trusting that the gun wasn't loaded. And I think that, you know, looking back for Alex, it's very clear that there was a long grooming process by which Summer brought him under increasing control. And that was part of it.
And so what was going through Alex's head when his team leader tells him, you know, come with me? And at a certain point, and I mean, that's one of the main questions I think you try to answer in your book is, when did Alex know he was robbing a bank?
Yeah, that is the key question. So when Alex first told me and the family the story of what had happened to him, he said that he had believed that this was a training exercise, you know, period. That was the story. I thought this was a training exercise. I would never have done something like this. I thought it was a training exercise. And when I first really pushed him on it, he went so far as to say that even in the moment of robbing the bank, like driving these guys there, seeing them jump out of the car with AK-47s, he's still thinking, okay, this has to be an exercise. This has to be an exercise. Summer has somehow set up some off-post final exercise before we deploy. They were on their final leave before Alex's first deployment, just like a little week-long block leave. And then over time, as I researched the story more, as I kept pushing Alex on that point because it just seemed so impossible to me, that story started to crumble a little bit. I started to see flashes of comprehension in Alex that came a little earlier than that. And I think, you know, not to give away the whole arc of the book, but by the end, Alex really came to grapple with his involvement at a deeper level and to admit to himself and to me that at least a part of him recognized, hey, this is a real bank robbery. And he was just too scared to back out at that point. Scared in a variety of ways. I mean, in right. one sense that by then he was pretty criminally implicated in preparations and concrete preparations for it. In another sense, he was just scared of Summer. He thought, if I go and try to report this to the platoon sergeant and some superior, I'm going to get laughed out of the room. Like, they're going to say, hey, you know, Summer, you've been planning a bank robbery? And Summer's like, this idiot cherry private. Like, these are just the usual Ranger thought exercises. And he's just, you know, taking it a little too seriously. And then Alex was terrified of what would happen on deployment with Summer after he tried to rat him out. So he just, I think he felt himself at a certain point, I think he did realize that it was real and just felt himself trapped into moving forward with it, even though he didn't want to.
And some of the stuff we're talking about here, I mean, even to me, it like sounds so ridiculous that, okay, you're a soldier in the army, got it, but how could you really believe that? But I've been out of the military for like 9 years now, and I left Ranger Battalion in 2006. So it's been a while. I really had to, as I was reading your book, I had to place myself back when I was in that position, when I was a Ranger Battalion private, and really think about those cult-like aspects of the unit, which make the unit very cohesive in combat, which is great, but there is that negative side to it. And I just thought about it, like, what if my team leader was a bad guy? What if my squad leader was a bad guy? And I was so fortunate, I know now looking back on it, that I had ethical leaders who, you know, would keep me pretty much on the right track. But what if that wasn't the case? And in that regard, I mean, I don't think I'm that different than Alex, especially when we were privates in Ranger Battalion. And I can see how this book you wrote represents going down a different road, going down a darker road.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's just as you say, it's really astonishing the difference it makes what kind of a team leader you have when you are a fresh, young private who doesn't know the new cultural norms of this group that you're joining, who's looking to superiors for cues about what's standard range of behavior, what's not, what's acceptable, what isn't. You know, you've suddenly been given license to shoot and kill people, which used to be completely against any moral standard that everyone you know lives by. So the rules are all suddenly in question. Like, your whole world has been turned upside down. You've just come out of RIP, or now, you know, the Ranger Assessment Selection program. And that's a pretty, upsetting experience. Like, that's, there's been a lot of sleep deprivation and exhaustion and pain, and you're just discombobulated and looking to someone, anyone, to set your feet back on the ground and get you comfortable in this new world. Right. And for Alex, that was Elliot Sommer.
You wrote that so Sommer and Alex both end up in jail. And you write that Alex was like doing push-ups and doing PT because he like really thought like this whole thing was going to be cleared up and he was going to go join his battalion on deployment.
That is completely true. He really felt like it had all seemed so normal to him at every step along the way. One of the things Sommer was really artful about doing is joking about these bank robbery plans openly around battalion with Alex and the other privates present, in a way that normalized it all.
Right.
Like, it really felt like everyone was just kind of in on this. This is just the kind of shit that Rangers do. And so Alex just, I mean, he was, clearly it was a delusional mindset, but he was just waiting for some superior to swoop in and make this whole nightmare go away. It just did not compute to him. It had all felt so normal. He thought he'd just been kind of doing what this tab was requiring him to do. It was almost like another one of these many hazing rituals that he'd had to go through to be accepted as a full member of battalion. And he was just, waiting for it to all be cleared up so he could go do what he'd been wanting to do for his whole life and deploy.
But on Sommer's end, he had yet another grandiose plan to portray his bank robbery as being about exposing war crimes.
Right. So one of the big wake-up calls to Alex actually was when one of his cellmates at the Federal Detention Center called him over and said, "Hey, I'm listening to NPR. This kind of sounds like that guy Sommer." And Alex listened, and there's Sommer on NPR, like, claiming to have, videotape or photographs of atrocities committed in Afghanistan Sommer's always acting out a different role from a movie that he loves. And he just shifted into V for Vendetta mode. He was like the kind of dark rebel hero who's speaking truth from underground in his command center in his mother's basement. And that was really a jolt to Alex. Like, he kind of expected Sommer to be still cool with everyone back at battalion and working things out with them. And it kind of became clear at that point that Sommer was following a very, very different script. So Sommer kept that up for a long time. A whole steady stream of journalists trooped up there to interview him in Canada. And then he was finally arrested in June of the next year, I think.
And oh my God, this reminds me, wasn't there, he told some story about a black helicopter like hovering over his mom's house?
Yeah. That's right. When I went up to visit, he claimed that there was this US helicopter that had violated Canadian airspace secretly to hover over their property to try to extract him. And I mean, he was just, The wild thing is, I mean, his family even kind of believed this by then.
Yeah.
It's so crazy the way that his fantasies would just kind of keep spilling out and enfolding those around him.
That's the really disturbing thing about a psychopath. And I've encountered a couple in my lifetime. And actually, one of them was a guy who was in Ranger Battalion. And it's unnerving for me personally. I don't know how you felt. I mean, you can tell us about interviewing Elliot, but I mean, for me, I work as a journalist and a researcher. I'd like to think I know when people are lying to me, but those guys, they get under my skin because they fool me initially.
Right.
But then over time, you can start to see the inconsistencies, and it starts to play out, and you're like, whoa, there's something really wrong with this guy.
That's exactly how the feeling was with Elliot. Yeah. The first thing that struck me when I got him on the phone for the first time, I was scared. I mean, this was like our family's great boogeyman.
Yeah.
And I'm calling him in federal prison, and there's this like scary warning recording that you listen to before you hear the guy's voice. And then he comes on, and he's just like, you know, hey there, I'm Elliot. You know, he's just this very friendly, normal guy. It took quite a while for that kind of creepy crawly sense to start coming in. Like, wait a minute, this doesn't really add up.
Like, he was even like trying to pretend he knew about math equations and stuff like that because he knew you had a math background, right?
Yeah. Except it's more than, I mean, he really was genuinely very interested in math. Like the sad thing with Elliot, I ended up having, some real sympathy for him by the end, because he's in some way just as trapped by this part of his personality mm-hmm. as everyone else is. It's not that he pretended to understand math. He genuinely thought he was a math genius.
Oh,
he,
wow.
Like he would come to me with these, what he thought were like great new theorems that he had proved. And they would have this kind of specious surface level consistency, a lot like the surface level consistency of the web of lies that you start hearing from any psychopath. But then you push on them, you know, like you blow on them with the slightest breath and they crumble. And then that was kind of crushing for him, because unlike bank robbery plans, math is kind of true or it ain't, you know? And so it was this arena where his grandiosity came up against the true hard constraints of reality. So I would kind of see that unfold again and again with him when we would talk about math.
Wow. It's just, yeah. So in that sense, he's a victim of a mental disorder himself.
I really did come to see him that way, but I also don't want to see him. I think prison is a pretty reasonable place for him to be. He may be a victim, but also he's just causes so much harm to people.
Right.
And doesn't seem able to help it or even really realize it while it's happening.
Is he still in prison today?
Yeah. He's still in prison.
But Alex Scott, he got out and he started his integration back into the world.
Yeah. He got out after 16 months, which is an extraordinarily short sentence
for federal crime.
Yeah, federal crime with, you know, automatic weapons. He was the driver. I mean, there were a few factors that led to him receiving a shorter sentence. He was the driver. He was the least involved in the planning. And there were also these kind of complex psychological factors that we've started to go into in this call. He started trying to adjust to life in America as a convicted felon, which, as it turns out, is just no picnic at all.
How is Alex doing today? Because I know you finish up in the book, you talk about he's working through that struggle. And I was just curious if you could update us a little bit on how Alex is making out today.
It took him a long time to turn the corner into really trying to pursue a new life and leave the robbery behind. I think for the first few years, he was kind of caught up in efforts to live out some version of this Ranger dream. Like maybe he'd be an EMT, maybe he'd be a fireman, maybe he'd be a policeman, just any kind of hero job. But you can't do any of that as a felon. And he kept fantasizing about somehow getting back to the Rangers, somehow re-enlisting, and even getting like new Ranger tattoos over time. And then I think just in the last couple of years, I saw him really mourn the loss of that dream in a real way and move on. I think he's doing better now than I've seen him since the robbery. He's got a really solid job. You know, he's got pit bull named Pickles that he loves to death and takes care of with a physical force that would kill a lesser dog. I mean, he has a good life. I think he's really moved on. But it's been a long and difficult journey for him.
That's good to hear. And there's something else I wanted to ask you about that I thought was interesting is, there's that family legend that you had amongst the Blums, which was, I guess, your grandfather, a World War II veteran. And you reference throughout your book that you're trying to track down. He wrote some sort of memoirs, and you finally find them towards the end of this journey that you and Alex, I guess, both took as you wrote this book. You found these documents, and you were pretty shocked by what you read in them.
Yeah, I was. I think our kind of accepted cultural stories about World War II are pretty, I don't know, simplistic and rose-tinted by now. It's the good war, you know. It's the heroic battle against the Nazis. There are clear good guys and bad guys. It's just great movie material. And so we forget that it was, like any war, just an immensely morally complicated enterprise and really ugly in a lot of ways for everyone involved in it. And I think in my grandfather's case, when I first read the memoir, I had a really visceral reaction to it because it wasn't heroic. It was ugly and petty. And he landed in Normandy a month after the invasion and was involved in, you know, so-called mopping up work, which is just an absolutely grotesque thing to be tasked with. He and his guys were just killing tons of pockets of remaining soldiers, some of them defenseless. And at one point they are the first to arrive at a forced labor camp after the Germans have departed. And they have to kind of take charge of this forced labor camp, in which there are all these starving prisoners and more of them die. It's just an absolutely nightmarish setting. And my grandfather, it does not take a particularly heroic attitude toward his work. He seems to have this kind of like, outlaw gusto. Like he and his kind of band of merry men are out there adventuring through the horror. And there's a lot of encounters with women that I found troubling. It's just an uglier picture of war than the one that Alex and I grew up hearing, which was just gilded in that glamorous heroism that World War II movies tend to be gilded in.
And speaking of which, we started off the podcast, Dennis and I, talking a little bit about something that I had written the last week about the video game series Call of Duty. And, you know, as somebody who served in the military and did some of the things that they show in these video games, I find these games to be like pretty nihilistic. You hear they repeat the mantra over and over: the winners write the history books. It's almost like this feeling that the only war crime is not winning, you know, that kind of attitude. And throughout your book, Ranger Games, I mean, you mention a lot of video games and a lot of movies and the influence that these media, fictional and non-fictional media, has on soldiers.
Nihilistic is, that's one word for it. Yeah. Or, you know, individualist might be another word for it. There's this kind of, deeply contradictory, marketing strategy, the army of one that was in force when Alex was recruited, in which the ideals that military service is supposed to embody are individualist ideals. You're out there for glory. You're out there to show your strength and your power and your capacity. And that's, you know, the video games are fundamentally really individualist too. I think that is an American ideal. There are some wonderful things about it, but if you take it to its extreme, it does kind of cut out of the picture those higher moral causes that that are supposed to unite us in the very serious matter of a military intervention. And I guess I saw a real absence of that kind of sense of righteous higher purpose in both the movies and video games that I looked at that were so important to these soldiers, and also just in the ways that they spoke to each other and the ways that they interacted.
Was that kind of your takeaway at the end of writing this book, about the military and about the process that these young soldiers go through?
I came into this process pretty staunchly anti-military, and came out of it actually much less so. I gained a lot of respect for the difficulty of the job, and also a lot of respect for the moral seriousness and the intellectual seriousness of so many service members. I mean, I interviewed a bunch of them for this book, and their baseline level of like political astuteness and engagement and awareness of what's going on in the world is just so much higher than civilians, just on average, in my experience. They tend to be very thoughtful. You know, when you're an actual agent of world history, you know, you need to be invested in it, and they often are. But I guess I just came away with a deep sense of how fragile that military culture is, how vulnerable it is to corruption by people who are in some way damaged or out of control. And so, you know, I think there have been some changes in Ranger Battalion and Ranger training since the time of this book. The tabs are, so, you know, there's no more RIP. Now there's this longer process in which some of the skills that tabs used to teach privates, they learn in a more formal training process, so that there's less of that problematic power that tabs had over privates when Alex was there. That's a positive step. You know, I'm much more sensitive to the possibility of abuse within Yes. military culture.
No, that's an awesome point, and I hope that people take that away from the book and from this conversation as well. Just from my two cents, I have a lot of mixed feelings as well. I mean, on one hand, I love Ranger Battalion, and on the other, I think your book makes some pretty valid critiques of the culture of Ranger Battalion and where it goes wrong. And then there's some things in there too, like Alex's, you know, his descriptions of going through RIP and Coal Range and all that. And I mean, I went through the same experience. I actually went through twice because I had the distinction of recycling the course. Sure. But it wasn't quite the horror show that it was for him. Like when I, and maybe it's just a difference of our life experiences and the different paths we took, but like, I look back at it and I kind of laugh and kind of reflect on it in a sort of funny way. It's a memorable, you know, coming of age story, I guess. But for Alex, who is really a horror show, you know?
Well, I think there's this kind of dual consciousness there where, yeah. On one level, I think Alex actually, if he had gone on to, have the Ranger career that he wanted, I'm sure he would talk about it in exactly the same way.
Yeah,
like it would be a rite of passage that he could bond with other Rangers about. They'd all gone through it. Like, they all looked back on it as something that seemed like, you know, existentially terrifying and painful at the time, but in retrospect, it's what everybody goes through.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious. I haven't gone through it myself. Do you feel like even at the time that you went through it, you had that kind of more mature remove from it? Or did you feel swept up in the process while it was happening?
I didn't feel swept up in it to the point that, like, this is my whole reality now, and there's nothing beyond the borders of Coal Range. I mean, I think I saw it as a selection process and you know the instructors are doing their job and they want to see what you're made of, so they're going to put you through some trials and tribulations out here. And you know, yeah, a few students may have been drop kicked, and you know, quite a few four letter words were hurled around, but I saw that kind of just as part of the process. But I mean, that's also, as you said, that's ripe for abuse too, because you know, you're inserted into this process and it's normalized. And there are some things that happen sometimes that are not normal and are not okay. And I think that there's that line there that we in the military have to do a better job at identifying. Especially, I mean, I've seen it much more now as a journalist writing about when things go sideways than I did when I was actually in the military.
That's interesting to hear. Yeah. I think maybe part of why Alex, experienced it as intensely as he did, it's just that he was so completely invested in this path. He just couldn't imagine his life going any other way. And he hadn't grown up around any military people. So these drill sergeants, the Ranger cadre were like his heroes. These were his absolute role models, and their approval just meant everything to him. So I think that amplified a little bit. But who knows, you know, maybe there's just a little bit of a temperamental difference.
Yeah, sure.
I guess I do a lot of research now on trauma and therapy and psychology, and I tend to believe that we all have, you know, on some level, some part of us, when we're in pain and when people are saying cruel things to us and forcing us to do things that we don't really want to do, there is some part of us, I think, that registers that. And I think one way of looking at military training is as a kind of systematic education in kind of devaluing that part of oneself, mm-hmm. in pushing aside one's sensitivity to that kind of discomfort. And I think that Alex, after he was arrested, when he'd been in prison for 10 years, he just kind of broke down. And I think that kind of inner sensitivity, like the little boy, you know, that he was before he went and did this, kind of came to the surface again in some way. He was just so cracked open. And I think he was really writing from that place when he was describing what he'd gone through.
And it's more than just that, though. I mean, the things you're describing can make you a very effective soldier, but it also explains why so many of us are just train wrecks when we get out of the military. Like we just can't live in normal society.
That sort of tender part of yourself, the part that actually feels those pains, the part that,
yeah, you
if
can't
you were in a, you know, just going to the post office and someone yelled the things at you that a drill sergeant yells every day in training, that would feel really wounded and shocked and taken aback. You know, that's the relational part that helps us connect and be intimate with people. And I think it's really hard it seems really hard for a lot of soldiers to get back in touch with that. It's hard for Alex too, even with as little military experience as he ended up having.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's definitely an important part of it, is like you do have to like reconnect with those emotions. And if you don't, you know, your relationship with your wife, your kids, with everybody around you is just a total mess. It takes, I think, well, especially guys who serve in a unit like Ranger Battalion. I mean, they're some of the most regimented and most hierarchical organization in the military, as you found out in your research. And I mean, yeah, it's a huge shift. But that also dovetails with some of your, you did a bunch of research also into, what was it, the Stanley Milgram experiments, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, the Milgram experiments and then Zimbardo's Stanford prison experiment.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Both of those, an expert on Milgram and Zimbardo himself, both got involved in Alex's legal case.
Right. What were your findings?
Those are some fascinating, fascinating and counterintuitive experiments. How much are you, were you interested in talking about that briefly?
I don't know, as much as you want to. I mean, I think it does dovetail quite well with your book and what we've been talking about so far.
You know, the one that's, that ended up being of most interest to me is the prison experiment. So for those who are not familiar with it, the experiment was run in 1971 in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Department. Zimbardo created a mock prison and stocked it with experimental volunteers. Half of them were randomly assigned to be guards and half randomly assigned to be prisoners. Within a week, the guards were subjecting the prisoners to such extreme abuse that the experiment had to be shut down. I published an expose about this a month ago. As it turns out, the story that we've all learned about the experiment isn't really true. The guards were explicitly instructed to create a painful environment for the prisoners, and they did so. Maybe the part that's most germane to this discussion is that I interviewed the guard who is most notorious as the ringleader of the worst of the abuse. He was nicknamed John Wayne. He had a Southern accent and was just sadistic as a guard. It turns out, he doesn't actually have a Southern accent. He was putting on an act. It was inspired by Cool Hand Luke. He thought that his job was to further Zimbardo's scientific aims by creating a realistically sadistic prison environment so that Zimbardo could study prisoner psychology. And he went at it with gusto. But he had also just undergone a really painful fraternity initiation a few months before, in which they did even worse to him than he did to the prisoners. And so he kind of had this mindset of like, man, if the prisoners can't handle this, like, come on, yeah. They haven't seen real suffering. I've seen real suffering. And that's the mindset that I think you see over and over in these hazing environments. It's how that cycle of violence gets perpetuated. You go through something like RIP and you think like, oh, you can't handle like a little, getting choked out on the floor of, the squad room, like during a little fight over Call of Duty, like you haven't seen real suffering. You haven't been through what I've been through. And it becomes this kind of rationalization for subjecting the next generation to the same stuff that already happened to you.
I remember having a conversation with, he was an officer, a retired Delta Force officer, who was telling me about how he was going and observing the British Special Air Force Special Air Service selection course. And he said the guy running the course was like taking these huge rocks and putting it inside the students' rucksacks. So they were already carrying like 100 pounds or whatever. And he was like putting these rocks. He's like, these new guys, they're not as hard as we were back in the day. They're not tough enough. We used to be able to carry 150 pounds. And the guy I was talking to, the American officer, was like, that's bullshit. If you read the SAS history, they were driving around in trucks in North Africa during World War II. They weren't carrying no 150 pound rucksacks anywhere.
These mythologies grow over time and then people kind of, become like enslaved to the mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you also build up the story in your own mind. I'm sure whatever I experienced in RIP is probably worse in my mind now than it was when I went through it at the time.
And they kind of become shaggy dog tales among like the soldiers who went through them together. There's all this RIP lore. Alex told some of these to me, well, ours was pretty bad, but the guys before us, they actually had to bear crawl through this field of used syringes that they used to practice injecting each other. And he totally believed all that stuff because it came from older, from actual Rangers whom he idolized. But looking at it now, it's like, yeah, it's probably a little embellishment that story picked up on the third stage of the game of telephone.
Oh, man. So what's next for you? I mean, you talk about in the book, because it is kind of a family history and a personal history, how you kind of went through this experience with your background in, computer science and math and decided you wanted to go into creative writing. I mean, is there another book in you that you're working on?
So I got very interested in trauma over the course of researching Ranger Games. I just wanted to understand what that did to the mind, the different ways that people respond to it. So I've been working on a book about, it's about what we talked about before, about the ways that people get in touch with that relational tender part of themselves. It's kind of about trauma and romantic relationships and, how to reconnect, in a deep way. once you've been through something terrible. That's the next project for me. I'm also working on some articles about a really exciting new trauma therapy that I've been learning about, called internal family systems therapy, in which you kind of explicitly name and get to know some of these childhood parts of yourself that you had to disown through the process of masculine training, either toughening up on the playground or in basic or RIP or wherever else. There's a pilot study out now in which MDMA assisted psychotherapy is getting a real clinical test.
We had a New York Times journalist on this podcast to talk about it one time.
Oh, cool. I find it tremendously exciting. I mean, they're seeing some really great results. Seems like it really works for some people. The therapists who run that have been trained in this internal family systems model, where you learn to kind of renegotiate these relationships with old parts of yourself. So
that's interesting. It's like the things you forget that you don't remember.
Yeah. I saw a really moving video of an Iraq vet who went through this MDMA assisted psychotherapy a few days ago. And he described kind of this going on this internal journey where he met this really angry, destructive part of himself that he discovered existed when he was deployed to Iraq, and which now terrified him. And he just described seeing how he had this part of himself locked up in a cage inside, because he was so afraid of what it would do to his family, to himself, to his friends and peers. And he realized that what this part was most enraged about was being locked in a cage. You know, anyone would be angry if they were locked in a cage. And he kind of came to this brotherly relationship with this warrior part of himself. It was very moving. It really seemed like it had helped him reconnect in some way to a part of himself that he'd had to shut out.
Well, I'd love to have you back on when you write that book or when it's published, because, you know, I think we've talked about it many times on this podcast over the years about PTSD and veterans transitions and all this stuff. And, you know, as individuals, we don't always do so well. And as a country, I feel like we really haven't figured out how to grapple with this stuff yet.
Yeah, it's a huge trauma. I'd love to come back and chat about it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for coming on the show today. And, you know, maybe next time around we can have you in studio. Be cool to see you guys. And, we'll do it again.
I'd love that. Yep. Thanks for having me.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Ben.
That was Ben Blum, author of Ranger Game, A Story of Soldiers, Family, and an Inexplicable Crime. We will have the link to that book you can buy in the description of the show, which you can find at softrepradio.com. And as a reminder, be sure to check out Crate Club. It's a club for men, by men, of gear handpicked by special operations veterans. All tier crates are available at crateclub.us. And right now, we are running an extremely limited promotion of 20% off for all SoftRep Radio listeners. This is the biggest discount we've ever made available, and we're not sure how long the promotion will last. So get on it right now. That's crateclub.us, coupon code SOFTREP for 20% off your subscription for all crates. Sign up today. Also, as a reminder to you, the listeners, now is the time to sign up for a Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show, Training Cell, follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of our membership for only $4.99 a month. That's specopschannel.com. Sign up today. Lastly, if you're not already signed up at the News Rep, you got to get on board. There's expert reporting and actionable intelligence from your favorite writers you've heard on here, like the man to my left, Jack Murphy, Stavros, Alex, and his incredible job on the last podcast. You want to read his writing, because if his words translate as well as they do audibly. You get unlimited access to NewsWrap on any device, unlimited access to the app, join the War Room community, invitations to our exclusive events, and it's all ad-free for members. We have a trial offer up right now where you can get 4 weeks for only $199. Sign up now at thenewsrep.com. That's thenewsrep.com. By the way, if you're not aware, there is our very own SoftRep radio app that you can download for free on iPhone or Androids. And our homepage is softrepradio.com, where you can see our full archive of shows. As always, keep up with us at SoftRep Radio as well. I thought Ben was very insightful. The only thing I was curious, and I should have hopped in. I would have liked to have known what Alex's thought. I mean, I'm sure he didn't read the book because he lived it, but what his thoughts were, like, especially being a cousin, like family's a tight dynamic to start with. You got to walk a tightrope. But Ben wrote this book about his cousin, about a story that actually happened, and it doesn't necessarily portray Alex in a great light. Like Ben said, he comes off in denial, and then throughout the course of it, he was like, all right, well, like you caught me. Like, I wanted to hear Alex, like if Alex even had a thought on how he came across after reading the book.
Oh yeah. You should have asked.
I should have. So Ben, if you're listening, send me an email.
I'll read it on the podcast.
I did. Yeah, that was a missed opportunity on my part. I'm still new at this. I don't want to step on your toes. You're the main course. I'm just the dessert. So I don't even know what I am at this juncture.
You're the mayonnaise in the sandwich.
Condiments are good. If you said lettuce, I would have been like, all right, that makes sense. Like, a good condiment helps. It's an enhancer. I guess. Oh, you know what? I'll take that. You can be you're the meat, and I'll be the condiment. That'll be our dynamic moving. I should have asked that. I'm already kicking myself.
Speaking
in the
of
ass.
Ranger Battalion stories, me and the other private, the other new private in our squad, Burkhart, who people have heard me talk about before, and he's in my book, and he's a firefighter now, really good guy. But me and him, we were like new privates on the same squad, okay. And our team leader called us Ace and Gary, the ambiguously gay duo from Saturday Night Live. So yeah, we were Ace and Gary. They would have like Burkhart do squats, and I'd have to spot him.
Oh, yeah. See now, that's what you guys were talking about. There's that hierarchy where, you know, they tell you to jump and you say how high. Like, ooh, spotting squats early on in battalion, that doesn't sound ideal.
Yeah,
and especially when you're nicknamed the
Ace and Gary.
Yeah, the ambiguously gay duo. In the short time I've known you, I feel like you leaned into that though. Like you got to embrace it.
To an extent.
It's like getting a bad nickname. You got to lean into it. Otherwise,
it's about there are some lines, and we're like establishing where those lines are is, you know, largely on the personality and the professionalism of your immediate leadership, you know. And, you know, some guys like, yeah, there were some things that were done to me that were, you know, technically, I guess, hazing, where I'd have to like low crawl around the bus. And then they'd tell all the other privates, get on the bus. And like, it would be like 50 pairs of jungle boots over my back because I'm right by the door.
Right, right.
They'd wait till I get by the door. And then everyone off the bus. And then 50 more pairs of jungle boots over my back. And I don't feel like I was traumatized by that or anything. I mean, it's just like fun and games to a certain extent. But again, there's a line there.
You had said you had a positive squad leader, team leader.
Overall, like it was positive, yeah. But, you know, again, if I was there, if I had a squad leader or a team leader.
Someone like Summer.
Or both, yeah. I mean, it would have been a very different experience, and maybe I'd be in jail right now.
I mean, that's a good point. There's two sides to every coin.
Yeah.
It goes, like, I played sports all throughout growing up, and a lot, like, the gap of what's now called hazing, and it's almost team building, or used to be considered team building, and you guys talked about it, how the mythology grows, where it was like, you know, like, my father walked to school uphill both ways in the snow with no shoes.
Want to see me throw this football over that mountain?
Exactly. Uncle Rico knows exactly what you're talking about.
I could have taken state.
But, you know, you get things like that, and You remember it. Like, I look back to when I played high school, and it was like, you know, we'd have, there wasn't regulations in for practice like they are now, because concussions were at their infancy. It wasn't anything what it is now. And we would practice 3 times a day. We were there 8 in the morning till 8 at night. And, you know, as it gets older, like I'll talk to, you know, my cousins or whoever that's younger that's going through it now. And I'm like, oh, you guys don't. And I'm like, how old am I? Like, what am I?
I remember talking to guys who did like wrestling in high school, and they'd be like cutting down for weight,
is like, you guys don't have to do that for the military.
No.
Because that is aggressive.
He was telling me about how they were in the sauna and they'd take credit cards and like swipe away their sweat so that because the sweat cools you down. Yeah. And that's not the point. I'm like, yeah, crazy. He's like, and the guy was like, yeah, I probably fucked myself up pretty good doing. Dude.
Wrestlers would make great military. Like we've discussed off air, you need a couple of those guys that are a little unhinged just to keep things in check. Wrestlers are the perfect subjects to jump into the military. They just to cut weight. I mean, that could, like a lot of them turn into UFC fighters and things like that. And to just have that, you know, you weigh 175 and you're going to cut down to 150 in 2 days. And you're just throwing on garbage suits, and you're just like I had friends in high school that where, you know, we get out of school and, you know, we're going to dick around at somebody's house or something. And my buddy would look at me and he's like, hey man, I got to cut weight. And we're like, all right, like, what do you want me to do? He's like, so we just load him up with sweatshirts and he's just running around our buddy's house. And we're just like, I mean, you got half hour left, like hop on the scale. Like, we'll help you out as best we can. But they're a different breed too.
In Ranger Battalion, it's very much like that in the sense that there is the Ranger way and there is the wrong way.
Okay.
And you say, but Sergeant, what about shut the fuck up? You know, like I was thinking about this the other day for some reason. Like I was in sniper section at the time. So we had to go out, you have to requal on fast roping every so often. So it's like a 34-foot tower with a rope. Like in your gym at high school, right?
Like Ninja Warrior, you ever watch it?
Yeah.
Climb
kinda like
Mount whatever, Midoriyama.
So, but instead of like fast roping out of a helicopter, you just go down this tower to qualify, right? Okay. So, you know, we were snipers. We went down the rope a couple times with our equipment and our guns. Okay, we're done. Another platoon from a different company. I think maybe it was Charlie Company. I can't remember. But this guy, the platoon sergeant, gets all of these young guys lined up at the tower. Gets them going up the stairs. Let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. And then as you grip the rope with your gloves on, you have to rotate out so you don't hit the frame of the aircraft or the tower in this case. So this platoon sergeant is just standing there on the ground with his hands on his hips and his cap kicked back on his head. Rotate ass fuck, rotate ass fuck, rotate ass fuck as every guy goes down. And then just like gets them in a circuit going right back up again. And he's just standing there, rotate ass fuck, rotate ass fuck. That's all he's saying. And I was like, yeah, that's Ranger Battalion.
Yeah. I mean,
that's just how it is. But like in the civilian world, people look at you. They're like you're looking at me like, oh my God, like what's wrong with you people?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say brainwashed. Cause that's not the right word.
No, that's probably the right word.
But that's how the whole adage of like we break you down to build you up. It's like rotate ass fuck, you know.
Rotate ass fuck.
We talk about if we go out here outside the studio right now
into this office
and we talk to and we just go up to we're in swivel chairs. If I went to somebody and I was like, hey, rotate ass fuck, HR is getting I'm gonna be talking to HR in minutes. But in the military, you know, it's just that guy's just. Chirping at you.
Another day. Just another day.
And with that, I think rotate ass fuck is a great way to end the show.
Rotate ass fuck.
We can't thank Ben Blum for coming on enough. Be sure to grab the book, Ranger Game. Obviously, it's fascinating story.
It's a really insightful book. I mean, I wouldn't say it's the typical Ranger Battalion experience. Most people don't have a psychopathic team leader, you know, and end up robbing a bank. But within it, I think there is some important commentary about, you know, military culture. And it's a hell of an interesting story regardless. And Ben really probed the depths of it. Like, he did a very thorough job interviewing and researching people. So it's a really good book. I really enjoyed it.
Also, I wanted to point out, he made reference to John Wayne. That was 2 John Wayne references in 1 podcast.
What was the first?
I was saying how the book, in the intro how we how it had like a Western feel to it, and you could picture like John Wayne.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you know, go figure. Two John Wayne references, the Duke. So shout out John Wayne, RIP, we miss you. Thursday we have on Jeff Kirkham.
Yes. Our Kalashnikov episode.
There's going to be heavy AK-47 talk. So
gun porn. I have to go for this one. I have to go to my bookshelf, and because I'm a nerd and I have all the manuals and the books about the history of the AK-47.
I'm sure.
I have to pull that stuff down and get up to speed so I can rap with Jeff about this.
Would you say that's the most recognizable gun, the AK-47?
I feel. Yeah, it's actually on the flags of one or two countries.
I'm sure. He'll know exactly which ones.
Yeah, it's the you know, the gun of the revolution is how a lot of people see it. Yeah.
Oh boy. All right. Well, that'll be Thursday, Friday for you listeners. So thank you, Ben, and we're looking forward to speaking with Jeff on Thursday. And that was Soft Rep Radio, guys. Be sure to tune in.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter @SoftRep Radio.